Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, May 15th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. We come to you each week from the Reynolds Journalism Institute with analysis of news media performance, especially when the media become part of the story. I'm Mike McKean, director of the RJI Futures Lab, and I'm joined by Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Amy Simons. Our topics: the Obama administration is surrounded by troubles this week, and reporters are more than a bit testy about how the White House is responding to the IRS scandal, the Benghazi talking points, and the Justice Department's seizure of journalists' phone records. Meanwhile, Bloomberg, the business news Goliath, is apologizing for its own invasion of privacy involving accounts of prominent industry and government officials. Those three young Cleveland women freed after 10 years in captivity are now captives of another sort, begging the media to give them some privacy. The New Orleans Times-Picayune does an about-face with plans to once again print a paper 7 days a week, and Twitter says it doesn't plan to produce its own news content. Well, they say trouble comes in threes, and that's certainly been the case for the White House this week. ABC News received summaries of emails that showed how talking points about Benghazi were stripped of their references to terrorists, Al-Qaeda, or earlier warnings by the CIA. An Internal Revenue Service manager admitted an office in Cincinnati had singled out conservative groups seeking tax-exempt status, and the Associated Press criticized the Justice Department for secretly seizing the phone records of AP journalists in its investigation of a news leak. At his daily briefing yesterday, reporters grilled White House Press Secretary Jay Carner about his and the president's response to the trio of controversies. Carney had little to say.
I cannot, and he cannot, appropriately comment on the specifics of an ongoing criminal investigation. This, I think, refers to this investigation, so I cannot comment on that. Again, I can't respond to this in the specific. When it comes to this specific case, I simply cannot get into the details of our view or his view of it.
Well, Jay Carney is an adult. He asked for the job. He's been on the other side of the podium as a White House correspondent, so there's no need necessarily for us to feel sorry for him, Lee. But I wonder if this convergence of those three stories, including one that directly involves a major news organization, seem to add a bit of sharpness to some of those questions.
I don't think there's much doubt that it added some sharpness. It's poking the hornet's nest in a major way. I think the other two could have been handled, especially because President Obama himself was very firm and direct about what was going on with the IRS. There are political reasons for that, but there may be others as well. But when it's discovered that the Justice Department is in a clandestine way seeking reporters' records, particularly phone logs, the honeymoon is over. If there ever was a honeymoon, people are now really actually kind of ticked.
And we'll get into each of those three stories separately in just a moment. But Amy, it seemed to me that the journalists were more than just a little ticked. I mean, they were making references to Nixon and Watergate in their questions.
And Carney right away was saying, oh, if you think that this is like Nixon, you need to revisit your history. Revisit history or not, for the administration to be going and getting phone logs from the Associated Press from more than 20 phone lines, that does reek a little bit of Nixonian times all over again.
Well, and whether or not we agree with the Watergate analogy, Lee, I mean, is it fair to say that, as some journalists and pundits have been doing this past week, that these three crises actually threaten the rest of the president's second term?
I don't know if it's fair to say that. I mean, this is a thing that history ultimately will judge. I think one of them is much more of a tempest in a teapot. I think the Benghazi thing is going to boil down to he said, she said, and we're not really going to have any resolution. The IRS thing, on the other hand, is criminal. And that's a big problem because people in this country are very suspicious of government. And the IRS is probably the single most disliked government bureaucracy that we have. So that's a real issue. issue, and the attempting to access records of the Associated Press, while that, I think, for most of the public is going to blow over, journalists are going to have pretty long memories about mm-hmm. that one.
Well, let's stay with the IRS story for a moment, because I tend to agree with you. I mean, all of these are being played for partisan advantage, but this IRS targeting Tea Party and related groups seems to have struck a chord with Americans from all political persuasions.
Oh, absolutely. And it's because Lee was saying people don't trust the IRS. They don't like the IRS. And to see that there's something going on with the IRS that people can point to and say, see, you're not being fair to us. That's right away one of those things that the Obama administration is going to have to work really, really hard to get around.
Well, and I would say, Lee, that the more reporting that's actually being done, the earlier that it appears that IRS supervisors in Washington, not just in Cincinnati, knew about these screening, and the closer the scandal seems to get to the White House.
Well, there's that. But I also think this is a place where we really ought to commit some serious acts of journalism. Having been on the board of a local 501(c) organization, I can say that we worried when the issue went to the voters about what we could and could not do as a board, as opposed to individuals, to retain our tax-exempt status. So I think there's a local story there about just what local groups do. At the same time, I'm not utterly convinced that the IRS did this solely for political purposes. If you listen to some of the stuff that's been on NPR, or if you have the good fortune to talk to your tax accountant, one of the things that they'll tell you is that there are some groups that skate really, really, really up to this very vague line about what tax-exempt status really means.
Well, I mean, I do think that's true. And these 501(c)(4) groups, I mean, there's some real questions about whether or not they are social welfare groups versus, you know, partisan political advertisers or actors. But I have to say, it seems to me that all of the efforts seem to be targeted at one side of the political spectrum. So that does smack to me of something that's pretty serious and pretty dangerous.
Well, and there are some groups, too, that are saying they're being asked what their stance is on Israel. And that it's not just necessarily limited to groups that are having Tea Party within their name.
And there was a Missouri journalist mm-hmm. who, on one of the stories that you posted on the blog, Mike, who said that he came in for additional tax scrutiny as opposed to other kinds of scrutiny after he did an interview, this was in 2012, that the Obama administration essentially took some pretty serious exception to. So, yeah. I mean, there it's very likely that there is some serious skullduggery of some sort here. I just think journalistically, we don't really know what it is yet.
Would you like to see more reporting about the 501(c)(4)s? I mean, it's obvious to anyone that there's at least a blurring of this so-called social welfare groups and obvious political campaigning, whether it's from Karl Rove or from the Obama side of the House. There are groups that really exploited this tax-exempt status.
Well, I would like to see some more reporting about it, but I'd also like to see some reporting that takes on the sort of public policy issues that have gotten us here. And at the risk of biting the hand that feeds me, she said, chomp, 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 the University of Missouri and local churches. There are lots of places that take advantage of the tax code in particular ways. And I think it's largely unexplored, but in this era, I think it's worth exploring in some depth.
Well, another of those pithy sayings we like to use in situations like this, it's not the crime but the cover-up that brings you down. And some are saying that this applies not only to this IRS scandal, the fact that obviously higher-ranking folks than earlier admitted it knew something and misled Congress about it, but also this week's revelations, we talked about the crisis in Benghazi. Now, I know, Lee, you say that maybe this is more of a tempest in a teapot, but it seemed pretty obvious that with the whole debate about the talking points and how many times they were massaged and whether or not the State Department or maybe the White House was trying to sanitize them in some ways, it's an important issue. And that sort of, even if the what happened there is more appropriate for a discussion about how we can improve in the future, this sort of cover-up mentality seems to be staining that story too.
If it's a cover-up, and that's the place where I get pretty hung up, because I don't know who's leaking, and the accuracy of the leaks themselves has now been called into question. So it's not clear to me whether we're going at this for political purposes exclusively. I don't want to make light of the fact that people died. I don't want to make light of the fact that we routinely as a nation send our diplomats and many others into harm's way. That is the part of this that I think needs serious, sustained journalistic attention. But going back and trying to resolve just exactly what happened in Benghazi on a second-by-second time frame, I think is pretty much of a fool's errand. We're never going to know, or at least I don't think we are going to know definitively.
Well, let's bring it back to the White House, State Department angle and sort of the muddying of what these emails allegedly showed, yeah. Amy. Started out last week, John Carl from ABC News reported that emails from the White House and the State Department showed that these talking points were being scrubbed, basically, of the controversial stuff. Now, Carl said in one passage in his report that these were summaries of emails, but then he kind of alluded to the fact that he'd actually seen emails later. Well, CNN's Jake Tapper, who used to work at ABC News, got a copy of one of the actual emails, and he interpreted it in a much more benign way than Carl did for the White House.
Well, and that's because he had the full text of the full email as opposed to relying on a summary of it. And when you're relying on a summary, you have to almost take for granted, which is a really dangerous thing, that what you're reading is what was actually communicated back and forth. And that's where this gets really muddy, because until you read the actual email, you don't know what's communicated.
But of course, it appears that Carl got his email summaries leaked to him by somebody in Congress, and the Congressional Investigating Committee said that the White House and State Department would not allow them to make copies of the emails. We all know as journalists that we can make minor or sometimes major transcribing mistakes then that way. And there have been some journalists who sort of defended Carl by saying this is kind of an old trick that White Houses have played all the time, where they say they'll take an obscure point and they'll say, well, the larger truth, you know, maybe is this, but we're going to highlight a small mistake so you won't think about it.
That's a way of spinning a story. What I'm sort of caught up in is, welcome to the wonderful world of journalists, especially Washington journalists, where everybody's got a spin and everybody's got a point of view. And even if we had access to the documents themselves in the order in which they were generated, and then we had a different set in the order in which they were received, we still could not go back and recreate that evening in Benghazi when you've got gunfire and all of that other sort of stuff going on. It's just, I mean, this is one of those places where I think having the original documents matters, but having to think about what the context that they were generated in matters at least as much. And that's why I said initially, I think ultimately it's a fool's errand. We're going to wind up pointing the fingers directly at ourselves and going, we need to do better, rather than being able to point the finger at somebody else and say, oh, it's your fault, you're to blame.
I think while we're talking about the reporting process in these three stories, I wonder too, Amy, if the fact that these latest revelations, whether they're big or small, about the emails, the fact that they're getting lumped in with these two other crisis stories doesn't give that Benghazi story more legs than it would have had.
Oh, it absolutely does, because people are already pointing at the administration and saying, well, what else aren't they telling us? Well, what else aren't they telling us? Well, there's a third example. What aren't they telling us?
And let's focus on that third story. This, if we want to call it a crisis, I don't know if it really is, but well, let's see what you say. It was the decision by the Justice Department to subpoena and seize phone records from reporters who work for the Associated Press. They didn't notify the wire service in advance they were doing that. The AP's president says that the Justice Department wanted the phone logs as part of an investigation into who leaked classified information about a failed Al-Qaeda plot last year in Yemen to blow up an airliner. Well, Attorney General Eric Holder said he didn't direct the probe, which I thought was kind of interesting, but he did defend it. He called the leak to the AP, quote, one of the top two or three most serious that he's ever seen. The AP countered by saying they held the story until the government said that those national security concerns had passed. And in fact, they pointed out the White House was getting ready to announce that they'd foiled this terrorist plot right in the middle of a presidential campaign. So what are we to make of this, Lee?
Well, so this is the cynical part of me. What we're to make of it is a couple of things. One, it's stupid to do this to journalists, and somebody needed to get their brain with them when they made that decision. And whether that is Holder himself or someone who's at the deputy level, it really doesn't matter. This was dumb, especially because AP has, as you said, you know, this proof that they didn't go live with the story until the government said it was okay. So there's no reason for doing this. But I think it also goes back to something that we've talked about previously on this show, which is that the Obama administration, contrary to sort of its stated posture, has been enormously tough on leaks, and within that, even tougher on leaks that the administration itself says I have national security import. Our problem as a profession is that it's our role to hold the government accountable for how it chooses to discharge national security issues.
Especially when it's the government that claims from the minute that it starts running for office that if elected, it's going to be the most transparent government in the history of our country.
Well, and regardless of your point of view on this, maybe you believe the media shouldn't be leaking this information if it endangers national security. Maybe you think that's our role. But a lot of groups were pointing out that at the very least, the Justice Department should have alerted the AP in advance, sought to get the records without legal action if they could. They probably couldn't. And then given the wire service at least a chance in court to challenge the subpoenas or the breadth of the records that they were looking for.
Well, this again is hindsight, but of course all of these things should have happened. I have to point out, okay, since somebody's going to bring up or has already brought up the history of Watergate, that there has since Watergate been a fairly aggressive approach, not just by government, but by corporations, to see if they can unearth who journalist sources are so that they can harass those sources. So, for example, Big Tobacco subpoenaed not journalist notes, but journalist travel records. So they could see where journalists were flying and then, you know, sort of reason it out. Well, who might they have been talking to? Oh, in Columbia, Missouri. I don't think anyone actually came here. So, I think that this is sort of the tip of the iceberg, but that iceberg has been building for more than, at least that I'm aware of, a decade.
Well, call it ironic timing, if nothing else, Amy, but just as the AP phone record story was breaking, we also found out that the business news organization Bloomberg was itself caught doing a bit of snooping. Many industry and government clients, for those of you who don't know, receive their news and real-time market information through what's called the Bloomberg Terminal. It's a specially configured computer. You have to have an ID and a password to log into it. Turns out reporters at Bloomberg had access to when clients, like Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, were logging in, and at least in aggregate what clients were looking at. Mm-hmm. Now, Bloomberg apologized. They pulled the access once Goldman Sachs and some other people complained about it. And they say that the reporters never had access to private information like their portfolios or individual stock trades or whatever. In light of what we've been talking about with these other stories, a big deal or not a big deal?
Well, in light of what we talked about on these other stories, and actually something we talked about last week a little bit that kind of irked me, is what happens when the news organization is owned by the same people that they're covering. It kind of feels a little bit like the same thing to me here, that Bloomberg is kind of in the business of covering the same companies they're providing the information to in a way that it feels dirty to me. And I think it is a big deal if they are abusing the access that they have.
I wonder, Lee, New York Times media critic David Carr used this Bloomberg story to say essentially this week that journalists are just as guilty as governments of invading our privacy through access and processing so-called big data.
I think that's right. To me, it's son of phone hacking, okay? All the brickbats that we thrown at Murdoch over in the UK about phone hacking. This is terminal hacking. It's no different. And if people want to believe that folks didn't have access to individual portfolios, maybe that's right. But I certainly do believe that the potential was there. And this is just one of many, many instances over the past couple of months where we haven't just tiptoed up to the edge of privacy. We've crashed right through it and then not even bothered to apologize afterwards.
And I would argue this isn't the same as a journalist who's going through and using data as part of their craft, because a lot of data journalists who are out there right now and using data as their main reporting tool, that's public data that they're using. That's not, in some cases it's proprietary, yes, but it's not proprietary to the point of we have access to this data because these people are our subscribers to a specific service that we are providing. That feels abusive.
Although in a lot of other ways, we have access to analytics that can get right down to the micro level of what individual subscribers are doing with our content, maybe not stock trades or that kind of stuff. So it's pretty blurry. I'm not sure the line is as bright as we'd like to think it is.
I think the line isn't very bright, and I think one of the sort of 21st century skills that we're all eventually going to acquire is how to be more private in a highly wired world. Are there things that we will just simply no longer do be online? We will wait to do them in person.
Well, while we're talking about privacy, let's look at another facet of this. Last week, local, national, and international news crews were camped outside the homes of Amanda Berry, Gina DeJesus, and Michelle Knight. They'd hoped to get a glimpse of the three young women who were reuniting with their families after being held captive for nearly 10 years in the home of Ariel Castro. As you know, the Cleveland man is accused of raping those young women, torturing them, and even restraining them with chains, dog leashes, duct. It's an ugly, sordid story. Well, we're going to show you a little bit of video here. And as it started out, these campouts, these stakeouts looked like celebrations. Here's Gina DeJesus in a yellow hoodie being escorted inside the family home while the neighbors are cheering her on. But, you know, it was clear none of the women, including her, wanted to be seen or heard just yet. And I think it was a more than a bit ironic for anchors like Anderson Cooper on CNN to be emoting about how sympathetic we all were with the ordeal of these young women while news helicopters were flying overhead just in case one of them stepped out in the backyard to get a bit of fresh air.
Well, and especially since we have, you know, all sorts of really pretty despicable images about what these women were not allowed to do. This is one of those places where I honestly want to say to my colleagues, what's the news story here? Because quite frankly, I can't find one.
There isn't one. That's why you can't find it. And these to be camped outside their homes at this point is the news media's effort to try and be first because they want to be the first one to see that face, to put them on the air, to talk to them. But this is shameful what's going on here. And as journalists, there's kind of this unwritten rule that you don't identify sexual assault victims. You don't put them on the air. You don't even mention their names in any way unless they explicitly give you permission to do that. The minute charges of rape were filed against Castro, this all should have begun to drop off if we were acting responsibly as journalists.
I mean, and I don't think we're really disagreeing with this. There are stories to be told. For example, how well did the police investigate this whole thing going back 10 years? And what's going to be the lasting impact on these young women, whether we mention their names or not? But the constant stakeouts and the phone calls seeking interviews, I mean, we know why they do it, because this story has generated such public interest and everybody's waiting to see who's going to land that exclusive interview.
But I just don't understand what the exclusive interview would be about. Really, you're going to give me more details about how they were tortured? The other thing that in addition to rape, we also have a young child who has now become very much involved with this. My goodness, we know her genetic inheritance now because that's been blathered all over the airwaves. And we have a lot of family history here that I'm not sure that it's appropriate, that I don't want it, and I haven't read a lot of it, but I've certainly seen enough. So I mean, I think there's just this whole thing here. It's like Amy said, it's an attempt to be first, but I also think it's voyeuristic, and we can stop that. There's other stories to cover, including the one that you mentioned, Mike, and, you know, including, gosh, I wonder how many other places and in other neighborhoods something like this is happening behind what turned out to be very closed doors.
I know, Amy, as intimately familiar as you are with television news, because we're talking about it doesn't mean it's going to let up. Somebody's going to pay that money or provide some incentive to get that exclusive interview, and this story is going to keep on dragging.
But you know what? Even if that were to happen, that interview would be so much better if the journalists who were going to pursue it would give enough time for these women to heal.
Yeah.
And the interest is still going to be there if it's a year from now or if it's a year and a half from now or if it's 10 years from now. People are still going to want to hear their story. So we as journalists need to remember we're also humans. Step back.
I thought it was interesting that the prosecutor's office was recommending a lawyer who agreed to work with the families for free and who brought in a PR consultant to work with them for free because of all of the media that they're going to have to deal with and all the legal issues they're going to have to deal with.
Well, and I suppose that if there is a bright side, the only bright side I can think of is not that somebody is going to pay them money to be interviewed in a news show, which I agree with you, Mike. I'm sure that's going to happen. But it's it's reprehensible. But there are going to be offers of book deals. There are going to be all of those kinds of things,
movies,
all sorts of stuff. So to have some sage advice, I mean, what I'm hoping is that one of the things that we don't know as much detail about is in the midst of all of this, there are some folks who are good at dealing with the psychological impact of these sorts of crises, and that these young women are getting as much of that sort of support as they possibly can.
And that's why it doesn't surprise me that they would make this kind of a recommendation and get them help, because it's victim services.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap up this week's show with a couple of brief updates on a couple of stories we've reported in the past. Last year, you'll recall we talked at length about the New Orleans Times-Picayune and the decision by the newspaper to cut back on the printed edition. They laid off a lot of talented journalists and moved toward a more web-centric operation. Well, not so fast. After a lot of complaining and some new competition in the marketplace, they say they're going back to 7 days a week of publishing something in print. Lee, what do you make of that?
I think, so this is the rosy glasses part. I think the community of New Orleans, and I am going to use the word community for very deliberate purposes, that the Times-Picayune was part of that community. And when the Times-Picayune decided that it was going to pull back, the community itself got mad. Mm-hmm. And we talk all the time about being connected with readers and connected with viewers and becoming part of the web of the community. Well, the Times-Picayune had done that, and I think that you're beginning to see the results. Also, there were, as the story you posted, there was some ham-handedness on their website and everything else. But more to the point, they had a role to play there, and I think people still want them to play it.
Mm-hmm. And it'll be interesting to see, too, if the community comes back to the printed product or if it feels so alienated by what has gone on in the past year that they say, forget it, you've heard us, we're gone.
Or if they come back to a printed product, they come back to the competing one from the Baton Rouge paper that's moved into the market and offered a New Orleans product to compete. Well, last week we reported that Twitter was advertising for a director of news partnerships, and some analysts speculated that this was tantamount to the social media giant competing with traditional journalists to produce and curate news content. Amy, you didn't think so, and turns out not so.
Yeah.
So Twitter's executive Mark Lucky is being quoted in an interview on PBS. He said, Twitter has no editorial team. We're not writing stories. We're simply providing a platform for other people to do so. And that makes sense.
Yeah, it's purely strategic. And they just want to make sure that they're in news agencies' long-term strategic plan.
But I would think we'd agree, Lee, that Twitter can be a bigger player in helping traditional journalists to tell their stories to more audiences and through more platforms.
I think it can and it can't. I mean, I think what Twitter should write is haiku. That's what you can do in 144 characters and do it pretty well. I think Twitter can alert people that there's a news story out there, but whether or not, especially the kind of complicated stories that we've been talking about, this is not Twitter feed. This is for something else entirely.
Unless it's serving mainly as a headline delivery service. Right. And that's what it's, I think, looking to be.
Well, we'll see who they hire, and maybe that'll also give us some indication of where it's going. But that's going to have to do it for this week, folks. I want to thank Lee and Amy for their insights, as always. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan, who's our director, and KBIA's Pat Akers, our audio engineer, for taking care of the technical side of the program. And thanks to you for listening and watching. If you haven't already, why not visit our Links blog? It's under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. When you go there, you can find stories related to our topics this week and from past weeks. You can also find audio and video of the show. It's also a good place for you to leave questions, comments, or suggestions if you'd like. Or if you prefer, you can contact us by email. The address is views@kbia.org. I'm Mike McKean. I'll be away next week, so join Amy, Lee, and Ernest Perry on Wednesday, May 22nd, for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.